Hi, everybody. My name is Earl. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Jesus Christ. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come home and the committee for asking me to come back to Seaside. I consider that a great honor and a privilege to be here. I also want to thank Wendy and Vicky for coming to the airport, picking me up, bringing me up here. I also, during the break after the film that they showed us, I met a guy named Dave, and I want to thank Dave for his kind words over there in the hall. I can't tell you how much that meant to me, man. Thank you. I didn't start drinking until I was 12. I had held out as long as I possibly could. I had been restless, irritable, and discontented for quite some time already. And, I mean, it was humble beginnings for me. I had a little pot, a little wine, no big deal. You know, I mean, I'd been shipped off to boarding school. My parents had a bunch of tests run on me, and they determined that I had this very high IQ. I don't have it anymore, so I'm not bragging. It's gone. That's been gone a long time. So they shipped me off to this boarding school. My father, how I got sent to boarding school, informed I was going to boarding school, my father walked into my room and said, get in the car. All right, got in the car, a bunch of relatives showed up, a little caravan of cars, drove, pulled up to this place. I got out of the car, my father got out of the car, nobody else got out of the car. Walked around, put a suitcase down next to me, and he said, this will make a man out of you. Shook my hand, got back in the car, and they all drove off. And I was 12 years old, I was 5 feet tall, so manhood was, of course, right around the corner. I was just busting into manhood all over, yeah. And I was a frightened child standing there wondering where the hell everybody was going. That's what was going on. And the fact was that I was being given an opportunity for a wonderful education that has held me in good stead to this very day. The feeling was that I had just been thrown away by the people who knew me best in the world, and I didn't know what I'd done wrong. I didn't know what I'd done to be thrown away by these people. And emotionally, it was just a devastating moment for me. And I don't know about you, but I've never really bothered myself much with the fact. You know what I mean? It's just however I feel about things, that's what's going on. And that's how I deal with the world, right? So I spent 3 days calling my mother, saying, you know, you really ought to come pick me up and take me home because this is just a big mistake. And, you know, she talked to me for a little bit, and you hear my father in the background, you know, hang up! She said, oh, gotta go. And after 3 days of that, it was like something broke inside me, and I decided, you know what, you don't want me, I don't want you. And I turned my back on my family, and I pretty much never went back. And as I began this journey alone in the universe, I mean, 12 years old, 5 feet tall, 103 pounds, absolutely no tools for living whatsoever. I'm walking around this school, on this campus, and I mean, there's 250 boys on this campus that are ages 13 to 18, and I'm 12. I'm the only non-teenager in the whole place. I'm the youngest and smallest kid in the whole school. Now, that doesn't mean anything to anybody except the 12-year-old. Because when you're 12, all you want to be is a teenager. Everybody else is. I'm not. I'm the loser. I'm the guy who doesn't belong here. This is a terrible mistake. I hate this place. Right? And I'm walking around trying not to make eye contact with anybody, and I ran into Tiny. Every high school's got a guy named Tiny, right? He's like 6'4", 240, plays guard on the football team. Actually, he found me, and he walked up to me and said, how you doing, punk? And he slapped me in the back of the head, sent me and my books flying, and I had this, like, out-of-body experience, you know, where you're watching yourself do something, but as your head saying, no, this is a very, very bad idea. And I walked up, and I hit Tiny as hard as I could. Yeah, real good idea. And I, like, looked up at him like, I'm always past anything I understand. You know, you're going to have to take it from here, man. I don't know what to do now. And he looked down at me and said, you know what, kid, you got a lot of guts. And he beat the crap out of me. And as I'm taking this beating, I'm thinking this is going pretty good. Because, I mean, I knew about taking a beating. You know, my house was not a happy home. And, it worked. I felt good about it because he had said, you got a lot of guts, kid. My violence had masked the fear. And that was my first tool for living, man. When frightened, attack. If you're attacking people, they're not thinking, would you look at how frightened this guy is? They're thinking, you know, who's a little maniac, right? So I take my beating and I go back to my dorm room and I got, you know, knots in my head, go back to my room, wait for the bleeding to stop. And word spreads across this campus like wildfire. Watch out for this little Hightower kid. He's a maniac. He attacks Tiny, right? So all the cool guys start coming around, and Matt swung by, and Matt said, took his head in the room, and I'm just sitting there looking around, you know, thinking, my life's really going great. And Matt said, you want to smoke a joint? And I said, well, yes, I do. And I didn't even know what he was talking about, you know. All I heard was, do you want to come with us? And the answer was, yes, I want to come with you. He could have walked in and said, we're going to go kill the Spanish teacher. Do you want to come? I would have said, yes, I do. I'm going to kill the Spanish teacher because I'm alone in the universe, man, and I got very large people attacking me now. I got to hook up, right? So, I mean, I hooked up with Matt, and we went down the dorm, and we picked up Steve along the way, and Steve had this container wrapped in tin foil, right? And I don't know what that's about. So we go behind the dorm, two 13-year-olds and a 12-year-old, children. And Matt, and you can tell Steve starts to unwrap this Tupperware container. You can tell by the way he's doing it. What's in here is very, very important. This is important stuff. And it's a Tupperware container full of cheap red wine. And I mean cheap red wine. No grapes involved wine. You know what I mean? And you know, so Matt fires up the joint, takes a hit, and hands it to me, and I just do what he does. And that's nasty. That burned like hell. Right here. Right? And then I'll try the wine thing. Right? The wine comes by. Nice pull on the wine. Nasty. Over there. I'm not liking this. I'm two total strangers, Steve and Matt. My lungs are burning. My stomach's burning. I got knots on my head. Tiny's out there somewhere. My family's throwing me away. I'm 12 years old. I'm going to be dead by 13, the way this is going, right? It's not good. And all of a sudden, I mean, it happens. That thing that makes me bodily different from my fellows occurred. You know, I got this feeling just kind of just wafted up out of my shoes and over my body, man. And all of a sudden, I was comfortable standing where I was standing, doing what I was doing with the people I was doing it with. And I had never felt like that before in my life. I suddenly knew, this is going to work out. It's going to work out. And I don't, you know, all of a sudden, it's good. It's just good. I don't have any problems. Everything seems possible. Everything seems doable suddenly. And I don't know, is it the pot? Is it the wine? Is it the fact that I'm standing here with my two very close personal friends, man, Steve? Because I'm feeling that connection, you know what I mean? I'm with my boys now, right? And I know Tiny's out there somewhere. It's like, bring him on. I ain't afraid of him, you know? I'll attack his fist with my face anytime. I got no... So I go back, and I mean, my parents, I'd had the little drug lectures, you know? Oh, man. You know, you go smoke some of that evil weed. You know, 30 minutes, man, you're on your way downtown looking for heroin. That's just the way that is, right? I thought, I feel no need for heroin. Say, you know, some of that wine, you know what I mean? You become a hobo. Shiftless, no good, riding the rails, you know? Didn't feel like catching a train. So I'm flying around where I was. The mist just went away, you know what I mean? And I thought, feel better than you've ever felt before in your life? Nothing. I mean, nobody went to jail that night. No blood was drawn. Nobody went to the nut house. I mean, all those things were going to happen, but that was not my experience at that moment. My experience at that moment was smoke a little weed, drink a little red wine, feel better than you've ever felt, get up the next morning, get your little books, go on to your little classes, everything's cool. I said, I got to do this as often as I possibly can, man. I made a decision right there, right? And I was very, very focused about that decision, and so I did. I did that every day for the next 16 years, no matter what. I was given many good reasons to stop along the way, and I never touched the brakes. I'm not a periodic kind of guy. I'm every day till you die. That's my story. So it's humble beginnings, little pot, little wine. 13 was pills. The only reason I took a pill was a guy, I was at this little gathering, and this guy said, do you want a couple of pills? And I said, well, yes, I do. And he gave them to me, and I put them in my mouth, and 20 minutes later, I'm laying on the floor, and I'm very happy down there. You know what I mean? And the guy swings by, and he says, can we get anything else? And the answer was, could you tell me what that was? Two and all, all right? Two and all. Write that down, man. That's asked for that by name. So, I mean, it was just two and all, second all, Placidil, you know, got crazy with all that. 14 was psychedelics. The only reason I took a psychedelic was because a girl, I was on a, hanging out with this girl, Debbie. Debbie. Debbie was a bad girl. And an older woman. She was 15 and a half. Hey, bro, I had such respect for Debbie, I gotta tell you. She changed my opinion of a lot of things. And she said to me, would you like to drop some acid? And I said, well, yes, I would, Debbie. Again, I have no idea what we're talking about. And she took out a lipstick tube and spun it up, and there was a little tiny pill on the end of it, and I took it, threw it in my mouth, and swallowed it. Debbie said, did you take that whole thing? And I said, well, yes, I did, Debbie. And she said, well, that was three hits of white lightning. Right, guy over here just went, oh, that's not good. Yeah, it was a very interesting couple of days. I came out of a blackout at one point, and we were in the market, a supermarket with a cart, and she's standing next to me. Apparently, we were married. You know? Oh, bad experience in the market. To this day, I have to have, like, to this day, it takes a real commitment for me to go to the market. It just got very weird in there. I mean, there's a lot of decisions that have to be made in the market. You know what I mean? I need a list. I go in with a list. I get my stuff. I leave. If it ain't on the list, too bad. I'm not buying it. I got to get in. I got to get out. You ever seen that abandoned shopping cart at the market? I understand that guy, man. It's just, not today. Anyway, I did about 650 acid trips, psilocybin, peyote, all that stuff. Got classified legally insane by the military a few years later. That's another story. 15, started shooting dope. The only reason I did that was I was on a boat in Marina Del Rey, and a girl walked up to me and said, would you like me to stick this in your body? And I said, yes, I would. She did, and I just did one of those. You know? And on the way down, all I remember thinking was, yeah! That was good. Yeah, I identify as an alcoholic, and I'm talking about drugs, and I gotta explain. I'm a child of the 60s, right? Our parents were the alcoholics. We were carving out our own identity. You know, we were not going to drink ourselves to death like our parents. We were going to kill ourselves in a whole new way. So we were very, very, very focused on the drugs. We were talking drugs. You know? That's all it was about. But you know what? Any realistic view I have of my life is in retrospect. Having gotten sober, stayed sober for a while, done my inventory work, and looked back, you know, reasonably upon what was really going on. And the fact of the matter is this. The drugs would come, my drug of choice was, what do you got? You know what I mean? I'm not a specialist. You know? I mean, if you did one thing into the dirt and crawled in here, God bless you, have a seat, welcome, right? That ain't my story, man. It's all anti-oral medication as far as I'm concerned. If I can get enough of what you got in my body, it'll kill the fear. And that's the whole point for me anyway. I got to kill the fear. Drug and alcohol use for me is just a fear killer, right? And the drugs would come and go. I mean, if it was, I mean, look, I prefer down and out, right? Heroin, alcohol, barbiturates. These are a few of my favorite things. You know what I mean? My idea of a good night is sitting around checking my pulse. That's a good night. And just the heart and lungs working. Nothing else going on. I like that. That's a very, very good evening for me. But you know what? If you don't have any things, I'll take a big bag of cocaine. We can't go down? Let's go up. Big bag of cocaine. Right? No problem, man. I'm perfect. Look, you want to sit around all night listening to the air around our heads, you know? Yeah, you, right? Yeah, right? Doing the window patrol, right? Driving down the freeway. Yeah, spend the whole night around that little vehicle, you know what I mean? Driving down the freeway, decoding license plates. Yeah, that's a good night. It's a good night, right? Because, I mean, for me, it's not about up or down. It's about I got to get out of right here, right now. Because right here, right now, I'm self-centered and afraid. Right here, right now, I don't measure up. Right here, right now, I'm comparing my insides to your outsides, and I'm losing every time. Right? Now, the drugs would come and go. I mean, I'm not a specialist, like I said. There was only one thing that was on the table every single day. That was alcohol. There was a bottle of booze on the table for me every day. And I think that there's a very, very simple explanation for that. And that's just my story. This is the way I feel about it. For me, that's the case because drugs are completely unreliable. I mean, there is no quality control going on out there on the street. You don't know what you got till you get it in your body. I mean, I never had a connection. I never went to Connect and had the connection say to me, you know what we got? It's just not up to your standard, girl. Come back next Thursday, we'll have something a little better for you. They never said that. They are, oh, it's good, it's great. You better have to step on this again, man. Be careful with that. It's a bag of salt, you know? But booze. You go get yourself a fifth of Jack Daniels. You go get yourself a nice quart of gin. You know what you got here. You can count on this stuff. This is reliable. And if you're going to be like me, which I do not recommend, you got to have something reliable there so that when you go to the party, it's 7:30, the party just started, and you've done so much cocaine, you can't get your mouth open anymore. And the party's just started and you've overshot the mark one more time, you know what I mean? You suck a little gin through your teeth, it'll loosen you right up and you can go on with the party. You're good to go. Act a little too spooky, don't worry about it. Jack gets you back in the comfort zone. Just start drinking, man. You'll be all right. Not enough heroin to get you to that quiet heart and lungs working place? Don't worry, Jack will get you the rest of the way. This is reliable stuff. And slowly as my addiction, my disease of alcoholism progressed, the drugs became less and less and less important to me, and the alcohol became more and more and more important to me. Until the end, I was doing 3-4 grams of cocaine a day just to keep me on my feet so that I could drink the way I needed to drink. it was about drinking for me. And when I get so sick I couldn't drink anymore, I'd eat about 150 milligrams of Valium a day. Not to detox. I never detox. I just retox. You know what I mean? You know, sitting on the couch shooting heroin, not getting a lot done. Cocaine, we'll get us out of the house, right? Craziness. But alcohol was my best friend. For, I mean, I had a guy walk up to me when I was 16 and a half years old, and he said, "You know what, you're an alcoholic." To which I replied, "What's your point?" I absorbed that identity effortlessly. Because I knew what worked for me in the world. I knew what made it possible for me to talk to you. I knew what made it possible for me to function on any level. And it was, if I wasn't drinking or using, I wasn't coming out of the house. It became like breathing for me. And it worked in the beginning. I mean, that's the remarkable thing about it. It worked great. And the consequences of that action were minimal. But as the disease progressed for me, that slowly over time began to change. And the buzz I got less and less and less and less over a period of years. And the price that I paid for that buzz just got greater and greater and greater and greater. So that until in the end, for me, I was paying a horrific price just to get to zero. It was not about catching a buzz anymore. It was about shaking off the beast, you know, just trying to shake loose from the beast for just a little bit, a few minutes, a few moments before you went back into the blackout. You know, and as the book says, and then oblivion, you know. And then that's what it was like for me in the end. When I was 16, I dropped out of high school. I figured 4.5 years of Latin was enough. Hit the streets. My father came back in my life, says, "You've obviously gone insane." Committed me to my first mental institution. They had me for 3 months of observation and a year of rehabilitation, which I thought was a little excessive. 3 cups of pills a day and a shot if you acted out. So my treatment plan was to get the shot every day, you know, figure out how to get the shot. And you're shuffling around in there, and I decided that one day that I needed to escape. And they had what, you got them here, the green exit sign. I used to look at that and go, there it is. That's all I want to do. Exit. That's what I'm after, right? So I decided I was going to break out of this nut house, and I was having my meals with this woman named Kilday. And Kilday was nuts, right? The guy over here nodded. You've never heard about Kilday, huh? Kilday was great, man. Kilday would show up for every meal. You know what I mean? We'd all sit down, and you sit down opposite Kilday, and you look at Kilday and say, "Kilday, how you doing?" And Kilday just, "Wow, man!" And freak! And they'd all go run and chase Kilday, you know what I mean? We'd all sit there and eat our little meals with our plastic forks. Like, every meal was like, you know, dinner and a show. You know what I mean? You know? Watch them chase Kilday. So I got Kilday as my diversion, you know what I mean? I was ready to escape from the nut house, so I flipped Kilday out, and she went flying off in that direction. Ready, 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 go! And I'm all an ass, you know what I mean? That's all I got. Shocking moment in the nut house when you realize that those 3 cups of pills are working. Because your head's working fine, and you realize you only got 2 speeds, man. I mean, slow and stop. That's it. But I'm the guy, I got the arms working and everything, and I'm going for the door, right? And over the loudspeaker, you hear, Ed, when you got a minute, you want to grab Earl? He's making a break for the door. Ed's in there having a sandwich going, yeah, I'll get him. He ain't going nowhere. Very demoralizing. Back to the room with no doorknob. So I talked my way out of there, spent a little time on the streets. They threw a net over me again, dragged me back in the nut house, and I escaped the first day. Because, I mean, my tools for living at this point, I'm like 16, 17 years old. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. I'm a high school dropout. I'm at any moment, hopefully, an escaped mental patient. This is like my resume, you know? So I'm busting out of this place, and whistles are going off, you know, and there's a guy chasing me, and I hit this backyard, and I'm flying across this lawn towards a 12-foot ivy-covered chain-link fence. I can see it like it was yesterday. And I am moving for that fence. They ain't got the Thorazine in me this time, bro, man. I'm on it. And I'm thinking, if I make that fence, I don't have any problems. Right? I don't have any problems. Because if I make that fence, I'll be loaded in 20 minutes. Los Angeles, my town. Right? That's my whole life. Right? My life, at this point, there are so many signals in my life. I'm 16 years old, and there are so many signals in my life saying, this is not going well, Earl. Right? Everywhere you look, we got serious problems looming. Right? Family, you don't want anything to do with them. You're completely disengaged from your family. Education has stopped. Drug addiction, alcoholism, becoming increasingly more severe, taking up more and more and more of your life. Relationships with other human beings, don't have them. Don't have them. Oh, it's never just Earl present anywhere. Because I'm loaded from the minute I come to in the morning till I pass out at night. But I'm young and my body can take it. So So I spent 3 years out on the street doing what you do to say hello on a daily basis. 20 years old, I meet this woman at a party. We talked for 20 minutes, so we were in love. And we decided we had to do something with our lives, so I went on an interview to a business college in Northern California. And this guy, I sat down with this guy, and he was a musician. So I was a musician. His favorite color was blue? That's unbelievable. My favorite color, blue. Right? I just lined up with this guy. And an hour and a half later, he says, I would be a wonderful addition to their campus in the fall. So I go back to my father, and I said, look, I got accepted to business college. Don't ask. Just write me a check for a year's tuition, and I'll get out of town. And he said, beautiful. Wrote me a check. Me and this woman piled all our belongings and 8 pounds of hash in the back of this truck and drove to Northern California. She got a straight job. I went to the school, said, here's year's tuition, transcripts are in the mail. They said, no problem. I get down to the local high school to get my high school equivalency done. So I'm going to college during the day and going to high school at night. She gets a straight job. I become a drug dealer. Right? I mean, I have absolutely no problems becoming a drug dealer because I have no ethics. I have no morals. I have no sense of family. I have no sense of community. I've been pretty much just figuring it out for myself since I was 12 years old. There's nothing in the way of me just becoming a criminal. So, I mean, I'm in business school. You know, I'm studying marketing and production and distribution. I'm applying it to my business. Business is booming. I got great clients all over the Bay Area, you know. I mean, when I flew up here today, again, and I apologize for coming to the conference late. Normally, I'm here from Friday till Sunday for the whole conference. But work didn't permit me to come until today, so I apologize for that. But I got here today on the way, you know, the plane stopped in San Francisco, and as we were landing in San Francisco, I just got this creepy feeling, man. I was thinking, oh, God, bad things. It's bad things. Anyway, 20 years old, I get 21, I get diagnosed to have malignant cancer. Great, made perfect sense in my life. Fly back to L.A., they do major surgery on my upper back. They prepare my family for me to die. They tell me I'm probably going to die. And I remember thinking, it didn't even faze me. I look back on it, it's amazing, but it didn't even faze me. I remember looking at them thinking, you know what? You don't even know who you're talking to. The way I'm using these days, that comes up like twice a week anyway. You know what I mean? People are looking at me going, dude, you're going to die. You keep this up. Like, yeah, right. I'm fine. I'm like, you know, every other day I'm the color of those balloons. You know, I'm just blue. Started overdosing a bit, and came back to L.A., did that whole thing, beat the cancer deal. I'm a long-term cancer survivor. I'm convinced. Yeah. Thanks a lot, but I have absolutely no idea what I had to do with it. You know what I mean? The only thing I can think of is that I wouldn't do their. I got sick of the radioactive, you know, nuclear medicine program they had me in, and I just went home and got loaded the way we get loaded. You know what I mean? I believe that my body became so toxic that cancer could not live in my body. That's what I did, you know. And I went back up to school, and then the next year, I mean, at this point, I'm like a junior in college. I got an early acceptance to go to USC Law School. I'm editor-in-chief of the college newspaper. I got a booming drug business. I'm making tons of money. I'm writing, you know, inflammatory political articles in this paper. They're threatening to kick me out every Friday when the paper comes out. I'm just nuts. And my mother calls me up and says, crying, and says, look, we haven't been anywhere as a family in 10 years. We'll go anywhere you want to go. Let's just go as a family. And I said, fine. And I flew back to L.A., and on my 22nd birthday, we took off the flight to Guadalajara, and on the way there, the plane crashed, and my mother, my father, my little sister all died in the crash, and I didn't. And I woke up on this mountain in Mexico, and my mother was laying right over there, my little sister Kimberly was right over there, and my father was laying right over there. And I had my skull was fractured, and my back was broken in 3 places, and my arm was crushed, leg crushed, I was paralyzed on the waist down. I had a lot of internal injuries, and I was awake. And I couldn't get to any of them to help them. I wanted to help my little sister so bad. Because Kimberly was, I never talk about this, but I don't know why this is up for me tonight. It's just, I'm in a safe place. I'm with you. My little sister Kimberly was 15 months younger than me, and she was mine. She was not my parents, she was mine. When she got to be, and wanted to know about boys, she came to me. When she had problems with her friends or a problem at school, she came to me and I dealt with it. When she wanted to know where to go to, I mean, she came to me with her life, and I was her big brother, and I was proud to be her big brother, and she loved me unconditionally. She's the reason I even know what that is. Did I have any kind of a marker at all in my life to say, that's what that feels like, you know, and that's what I want to be able to get back to. Not just getting it, but giving it. And I couldn't get to her, and she bled to death. And I felt like she was my responsibility, and I let her down. And then I had a little conversation with God, and I said, you know what, any God that would take a kind, gentle, loving little creature like her and leave a lion, cheat, thieving, dope fiend, alcoholic like me on the planet, I have no use for a God of this type. And I renounced God. And then some guys came up and they scavenged the plane wreck, and they came by and took my wallet, took the money out of my wallet, and threw it back in my chest and moved on to the wreck and got what they could get and went back down the mountain and left me up there to die. So I had no more use for you either, man. I was out of the game. I had no love of man. I had no love of God. I was just completely alone in the world. My family was laying there dead, and I was angry. And I started hitting myself in the side. I don't think I could move with my right arm, and I started hitting myself in the side because it hurt so bad. The pain would yank me up out of the shock because I knew I was shocking out. And I knew I'd die if I didn't. And finally, some guys came up, and they took me, put me in the back of a truck with my mother, and they tagged her dead, and they tagged me dead, and they took us to a Mexican aid station, and they sat around smoking cigarettes waiting for me to die, and I didn't die, and they finally took me to the hospital, Fatima, in Los Mochos, Mexico. They kept me there, and then the federales found out who I was, so the federales showed up, and they interrogated me through an interpreter for 3.5 days, wanting to know what I was doing back in Mexico, which, again, is another story we don't need to get into here. And I finally called a buddy of mine up in Northern California who called the family in Mexico City who flew in the plane, paid a few people, they plastered me from the neck down and smuggled me out of Mexico. I spent a lot of time in a hospital in Santa Monica, California. And I came out of that hospital with a brace on. They told me I might be paralyzed in the waist down, might have a withered left hand, and be blind in my left eye. None of that was true, and I worked real hard, and I got out of that hospital. I was strung out on Demerol, and I was crazy. I mean, I didn't know that I was ashamed to be alive. I didn't know that I felt I had no right to be breathing in and out, that I had what they call survivor's guilt, post-traumatic stress, all this other stuff, right, that these labels that they put on what's wrong with you. And I don't discount the truth. I mean, all those things are certainly true of me. But what was most prevalent in my life was that I was an alcoholic, and I was in excruciating psychic pain. And I only had one thing that could work for a guy like me, and I went on a drunk, and it lasted for 6 years. And you got to understand, I didn't have any anchors at all in my life. I didn't have a family that I had to keep it together for, a job I had to keep it together for, a career that I had to keep it together for, kids or friends or family. I mean, I had no anchors. I was just loose out there, out of my mind, with pictures in my head of these people dying that I knew I couldn't live with. I knew I couldn't live with. And I just couldn't get drunk enough. And it lasted for 6 years, and about 4 years into it, I'd gone to this little every once in a while I'd get so sick I knew I was dying, and I'd go to this little bootleg sanitarium in Hollywood, completely illegal joint where you give them 150 cash up front, and give them your money and your car keys and your Valium and your gun and everything, and you go and they strap you to a gurney, shoot you full anticonvulsants and let you ride, and you'd reintroduce yourself to God on a kick like that. You know, I'd say, look, you get me out of this sane and alive, I'll never, never drink again as long as I live. And I remember 2 years before I stopped drinking, I hit my bottom. My ass was kicked. I knew it. I'm laying on that gurney, dying, and I said, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict, I can't drink anymore, I can't take this life, I can't take the insanity, I can't take the madness, I can't take one more second of living like this. God, if you get me out of this sane and alive, I will never, ever, ever drink again. And I meant that with every fiber of my being, and I drank for 2 more years, because I could not stop drinking, and the madness just went completely sideways in my life. And when I got, the last time I came out of a blackout, I had hair out like this, a beard out like this. I was psychotic, and I don't use the term loosely. I could not distinguish between the true and the false. I'd come to and I'd remember something. I didn't know somebody tell me that. Did I do that? Did I read that? Did I dream that? I didn't know. It was just this big mad blur. Family was dead, had no friends, had no place to live. They were deciding whether or not to charge me with attempted murder again. Both my hands were broken. I'd broken 74 bones. I had over 650 stitches in me, and I was dying of alcoholism. Thyroid shut down. Heart swollen. Couldn't touch the kidneys or the liver. And I came out of the last blackout. I mean, and I've been in that kind of shape before. And I came to, and I just suddenly, I had my moment of clarity. And my sponsor later pointed out to me that for guys like me, the bottom is dead. That's the bottom. What I had was, I hit a bottom of an emotional and spiritual nature where I was completely clear on this point. I was not connected to another human being on the face of the earth. And that was a direct result of my behavior. God didn't do this to me. My father didn't do this to me. The police didn't do this to me. The FBI didn't do this to me. I was doing this to me. And if I didn't want to die, I was going to have to get some help. So I raised up two busted hands and I said, help. And they took me by ambulance to USC Emergency, and they pumped my stomach one more time. I had my stomach pumped so many times I could talk to you while you did it. You know, they'd run the tube. How you doing, Earl? Bad day. And they said, get him out of here, he's dying. I was just a pathetic old man drunk. And it was the day before my 28th birthday. And they took me to another place, kept me 5 days. I got worse. They took me to another place. And this place was the place, man. This place was hell on earth for an alcoholic. And it was where I needed to go. It was 42 cots in one room. 21 cots on each side of the room. And they drew a sheet between each cot. Right? And how you earned your cot was you stayed in it. And there was no medical detox. There was no, here, we'll help you get some sleep tonight. There was no, we'll get that shake off of you. You know, we'll get the madness up off of you. Their attitude was, you're about to be introduced to what your body really thinks about what you've been doing to it. Right? And if you threw a seizure, they'd give you anti-seizure medication because they didn't want you to convulse to death on them. But that was it. That's all you got. So I got in my cot. Of course, you know, within a few hours, I bucked right up out of that thing. So they hit me full anti-convulsant, threw me back in the cot, and I laid there and I rode. I rode because I knew if I didn't, I was going to die. If I was going to die in that cot, so be it. And that's, of course, what it felt like. And 17 days later, they put me in a 30-day... Their idea, how you got out of detox and into rehab, is they give you one of those little styrofoam cups, and they put about half a cup of decaf in there. And with one hand, if you could pick that up and get it to your lips without splashing it all over the room, you were ready for rehab, man. Out of detox. So, you know, you're just thinking, you know, just please, come on, man, come on, come on. Because I had a yip for 2 years, you know what I mean? We'd be sitting talking to somebody, you'd be writing something down, all of a sudden just get the yip. And I stayed 30 more days in there, and I came out of there and I knew one thing. They said, Earl, yeah, you're an alcoholic, and you don't want to die, you better go to AA, because it's the only place a guy like you can survive. And I said, okay. And I came to AA, and I went to the basement of a church on a Friday night, and I sat in the back, my arms folded, that tough guy look on my face, man, no tools for living, destroyed, out of my mind. And an old guy got up here, man. He was a wino, ex-boxer, and a Skid Row bum. I thought, I'm none of those things. Because I can spot the differences between you and me immediately. But I didn't have anywhere to go. I had absolutely no place else to go. If I had some place else to go, I'd have gone there. I came in with my life destroyed. It was just this barren wasteland in every direction. You know, I feel for the guys who come in and have that area of their life where they can say, well, you know, it was going pretty well there. I didn't have one of those. Right? I just sat in the back with my arms folded, knowing this guy had nothing for me. And he shared his experience, strength, and hope. I didn't know that's what he was doing, but I know that's what it was today. And he changed my life. He talked openly and honestly about his feelings as a man, and I'd never heard anybody do that before. With that kind of grace and that kind of dignity like he had. He just told me the truth about who he was. And then it was like he looked right at me and he said, you know what, I don't care whether you like what I got to say or not, you don't like it, go to another meeting. And I thought, that was great. Because it made it clear to me, this guy wasn't selling me something, he was sharing it with me. If I wanted, I could have it, it was for free. If I didn't go to another meeting, maybe I could hear somebody else I could identify with. And that moment, right there, was a turning point in my life. I didn't know it at the time, but it was. Because I got up and I left that meeting with something I hadn't had in years. Because I am a hopeless alcoholic. And that man gave me hope. I think that's the greatest gift one alcoholic can give another, is hope. And he gave me hope. And I left there, cried all the way home, paced, trying to get my hour of sleep that I was getting in the beginning. And I'd gotten this little job as a house painter, and I'd go stand by the coffee pot in a paint store, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning, just, crazy. Said, you know, somebody hire me because I got to go to work hard now. And painting was perfect because, you know, just that Navajo white on Navajo white, man, painting apartments, you know what I mean? Just this blank canvas, my insanity to just pour out on. I'd just paint that wall till I hit a corner, you know, and turn. You know? Just crazy. These guys loved him. He said, hire that high tech kid. He's out of his goddamn mind. Get him out there, man. Just a machine all day long, right? Because I gotta get exhausted to get something to eat, go to a meeting, try to get a couple hours of sleep, get up and do it again, you know? Just crazy. Going to meetings, said, get a sponsor. I said, okay, what's the sponsor? And they said, the sponsor, somebody's got what you want. I said, well, dude, I want a drink. You know? Probably a little early to be throwing a ball back in my court, man. Yeah, and I have since come to believe what I want a sponsor. I want a sponsor who's got what he wants. Because that's the best definition of happiness I've ever heard, wanting what you got. And I looked for a sponsor, I found a crazy man. The late, great Donald Madden was my sponsor. And yeah, baby. Donald Madden. Madman. The madman. This man was committed to the nut house 23 times. He's the only man I've ever known was evicted from the nut house. They told him, you have to go. You got to get out of here, because if you don't go, you're going to be one of the ones that never leave. And they threw him out into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he got sober and stayed there and was waiting for me. And I showed up, and I said, will you sponsor me? He said, what? I said, will you sponsor me? He said, yes. And you don't have to like what I tell you, You don't have to think it's a good idea. You just have to do it. And I said, all right, you know, don't get carried away with yourself, man. You know, I'll just settle down. And then I just put my head down on the desk and cried like a baby because I realized I had just asked somebody for help. And I couldn't remember the last time I had done that. And as I'm laying there blubbering like an idiot, he looks over me to his assistant and says, oh, wonderful, he's destroyed. I look up from the table thinking, what have I done? I just threw my life over this guy who's thrilled and I'm destroyed. And what he was happy about was he saw that I had no more good ideas. I was not going to debate with him what would be the next good move for me. You know what I mean? That I was just this empty vessel that he could just throw AA into, which is what he did. He'd call me. This guy was so far beyond what a normal, what you should expect from a sponsor. I can remember being in my apartment. I had a little one-room apartment. One room, and I had, in those days, a telephone and an answering machine. I had the answering machine set up so that you never heard the phone ring, and you never heard the outgoing message. All you heard was you'd be in there, and you'd hear beep, and somebody talking. Right? So I remember it was like 7 o'clock in the morning one morning, a Saturday morning, and I had like an hour and a half sleep. And I'm laying in the bed. All of a sudden I hear, beep, wake up! And it's Donald's voice. And I'm just like, I went from laying in the bed to up. Just, and he said, we're having a day. And I thought, oh my God, they have bed checks in AA. This guy's everywhere, right? And I remember being in a meeting. I never took a chip. I never took a chip. I didn't take a cake till I was 3 years sober. I didn't say a word in Alcoholics Anonymous until I was 2 and a half. I'm not one of the guys that was raising his hand saying, hey, I got a lot to say, let's hear from me. I never wanted to do this, to be up here. This was one of the greatest fears of my life. And I remember the day Donald Madden said to me, you know, Earl, you never talk to anyone. You're gonna end up sponsoring a lot of people and speaking in AA. And I looked at him like, you're high, man. That's just not me. I'm the guy in the back who does the cleanup, who sweeps up after everybody's gone. You know, who takes out the trash, or will come early, make the coffee, and get everything ready, and then disappear, and then come back for, you know. That's me. I don't do that. I remember the day, it was a Saturday night, Ohio Street. I was standing in the back, and I was done. I'd hit the wall. I was about a little over two years sober, and I'd hit the wall. I couldn't go another step. It was over. My head was chewing on me, telling me what a worthless human being I was, and that I had no right to hope for a better life. I had no right to it. They died. I'm here. You have no right to be happy, Earl. And you're thinking you're about to get that way here in this A&A thing, so let's just knock all that off. And I was just caving in on myself in the back of this meeting. And the main speaker's up talking. Donald was sitting in the meeting, and he looked back, and he saw me back there caving in on myself. He gets up, he walks up to the front of the meeting, taps the speaker mid-talk on the shoulder. Says, excuse me. Speaker steps aside. Donald walks up to the microphone and says, oh! And I'm in the back of the meeting, and I just went, wow! And he looked at me and said, we're having a meeting. And I went, back, thank you. The whole meeting's going, who the hell's Earl? Steps back, the speaker comes back up, and Donald goes, sits down, the speaker just goes, I don't know what the hell that was about, and just goes on about with his thing, right? He knew when to love me, and he knew when to kick my ass, you know what I mean? It was like, no, you got to stay here with us. He was much more interested in my staying alive than he was me liking him. And as a result, I grew to love and respect him more than any other human being I've ever known in my life, because I was with him longer than I was with my own parents. I left home when I was 12 years old. I was with Donald Madden for almost 14 years, right up until the day he died. And the day he died, it broke my heart. And those of us that were sponsored by him, we all went and sat with him, waiting for him to come get the body. And I was watering his garden, because his garden was real important to him. And I heard a voice in my head, and it was Donald Madden. He said, you get a sponsor, you little son of a bitch. You're not sober enough to be walking around out there by yourself. So I called up a guy that Donald Madden respected, and I said, Donald, is that what you sponsor me? He said, yeah. So I was without a sponsor for 3 hours. And now I'm a guy, I go to 7 to 9 meetings a week. I'm sponsoring a legion of guys. I talk to my sponsor. To this day, I see my sponsor on a weekly basis. Every Monday night I go to a meeting. I put the chairs away. I'm the assistant chair putter away guy on Monday nights. It's the greatest commitment in AA. Because I take the chairs from them and I hand them this guy. The only part that I have a little trouble with, and it ends up on every inventory I do, is apparently they don't feel that I'm qualified yet to actually put the chairs away. So I hand him to the guy who does, and he's only got 4 years sober. So apparently, he's doing far better than I am, and I would like to know why. Anyway, just a little beef I got, but I've been doing... So I'm going to keep this commitment. I don't care how long I got to do this. I'm going to keep it till they promote me. And I've been sober now 21 years. Yeah. Trust me, you're clapping for yourself, because... I guarantee you that my having 21 years of sobriety has absolutely nothing to do with any of the thinking I brought here. None. It has to do with being an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I found a way to live here. This goes so far past not drinking and using, I can't even tell you. I can't even tell you. So far past not drinking and using, I can't tell you. I lost the buzz out there. I became about the buzz, and I lost the buzz. Slowly but surely out there, the price I paid to get high got greater and greater and greater, until in the end it was horrific what was happening to me. And I wasn't getting high at all. I was catching no buzz at all. I came in here, and it was nasty. Being new was nasty. So, I mean, if you're out there and you're new, congratulations. I got nothing but respect for you. And I don't care what's going on inside your head. If your ass is in the seat, I got respect for you. I have more respect for a 30-day chip than any other event that takes place in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I think that is absolutely remarkable. You know what? And I'm not trying to be politically correct. I'm telling you the truth, man. If you're new, understand me. I'm not blowing smoke up your ass. I really believe that. I believe it's a remarkable thing for an alcoholic to get 30 days without a drink. That's an amazing thing. Because when you think about it, out there, it's exact opposite in here as it is out there. Out there, the best buzz I ever got was right up front. And I chased the tail of that dragon for 16 years on a daily basis, so I almost paid for it with my life. In here, you come in here and you work your ass off to get that 30-day chip, man. That's hard, because you got no tools for living. You didn't, like, check the steps out on the wall and go, okay, I got that, now what do you want to do? You know what I mean? There's worlds and then worlds there. You can't just brush up against that stuff and get it. It takes time. That's the bad news in here. The bad news, it takes time. Right? The good news is it works. You know? And you got to show up and you got to do it. You got to keep going. You got to keep going. You got to keep bumping up against the madness. You got to keep listening to that whispering, because when I came in, man, yeah, I had kicked. But that was a small, small aspect of my disease. The mental obsession was in full effect for me. I had a head raging full of alcoholism when I got here, and the beast was whispering in my ear all day, every day. All day, every day. I've been reading that book, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on, and the book's saying, you know, the day will come when you'll have no human defense against first drink, and I'm thinking, well, I'm screwed then, man. Because I thought, I'm going to be sweeping up Ohio Street. Right in the middle of a commitment. Sponsor standing right over there. All of a sudden, my head's going to explode. Just going to go, drink! I'm going to drop them off and go racing over to the liquor store, have the bottle of gin, be back behind the liquor store. You know that feeling, the stucco in your back, you know, because you're kneeling down? Because you ain't got time to get home. Get a glass and all that sort of stuff, you know what I mean? It's like, now. And I'm going to praise that bottle up and think to myself, I wonder where we're going now. That's what's going to happen to me. But it's not like that. The book says it's cunning, baffling, and powerful. And they ain't lying, man. Those are the perfect words for the beast. Because it whispers in my ear. I'll be sweeping up in Ohio Street, and the beast whispers up and say, how you doing, huh? How you doing, man? You're having a bad day, aren't you? I can feel it. You're having a bad day. You're very, very stressed. Very stressed. And we all know stress is very, very unhealthy. And I don't know what it is. It's like you got a bullseye on your back. People hitting that bullseye all day long. It's treating you terrible. And I don't know why. Because you're a hell of a guy. You're a hell of a guy. And I'm here for you, and I love you. You know I love you. I've always been here for you, and I'm never going to leave you. You know that, don't you, world? You know I love you. I'll be here for you. And here's what I think we need to do. Right? This is what we need to do. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to go out. We're just going to have a couple of drinks. No. Hey, don't overreact to what I'm saying here. We're just going to go have a couple of drinks. You heard me say it, didn't you? Two. I didn't say three. I didn't say four. Not going to happen like that. It's only going to be two. We're going to have two drinks. We're going to unwind that spring inside you, man. Get that stress off you. I'm here for you. We're going to work our way through this. All right? And let's just keep this between you and me. Let's just keep this between you and me. You know, and we'll slide on back into these meetings, no harm, no foul. Okay, brother, I'm here for you, I love you. And I'm sweeping up behind you going, yeah, that's very reasonable. Now, I got 16 years on a daily basis says, that is not what's going to happen. That is not what's going to happen. But that's the obsession of mine. I got to be relieved of that. And luckily, I came across some guys in the fellowship that understood what the program was. See, I was going to 7 or 9 meetings a week, talking to my sponsor, sponsoring guys, commitments all over the place, taking out panels, doing all this stuff. I was like an little AA machine, man. I'm doing all this stuff, thinking, I got a program, man. I got it going on. So I got squirrely and walked up to an old timer and said, I'm feeling a little squirrely. And he said, of course you're feeling squirrely. Look at you. What? You know? He said, Earl, love the fellowship. Vital to your recovery. Glad you got it. But if you don't get a program, you're going to die. Go away. What the hell are you talking about, man? Look at all this stuff I'm doing. He said, fellowship. Vital to your recovery. Glad you're doing it. Program will be found in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, Earl. I suggest you get the book and read it because your life depends upon it. Get away from me. I said, all right, you son of a bitch. I'll get a book, right? So me and my buddy get this book, and we start looking at it, and we thought, well, probably the way to do this is if there's some writing there, we should probably read it. So we read it. And on the cover back then, they had a circle with a triangle around it. Found that was an ancient spiritual symbol. They're all over this room. Right? It was, you know, mind, body, and spirit brought together as a whole human being. And therein lied the balance I'd sought my whole life and never had, drunk or sober. Drunk, obviously, but sober was the same thing. You take a drunken maniac like me and you sober him up, you got a sober maniac. I come in and say, what are you guys doing? I go, work out. I go, great, work out. So I'm working out. I worked out till I literally ripped a muscle from the bone. You know what I mean? Just working out, working out. Get this great skate. Seems to be a problem over there. You know, just a madman. He said, run, right? I got 74 broken bones at the time, right? Running is not an option for me. You know, I just snap and crack and, right? And they told me that I couldn't run, and I said, so I ended up, I ran a half a marathon, so I was hallucinating, stress fractures in my feet, you know what I mean, dislocating ankles, you know what I mean, but I'm running. I'm not a, like, middle-of-the-road guy, you know what I mean? And I'm in AA, and I'm acting like this. And they said, this mind, body, and spirit brought together as a whole human being, and therein lies balance, the thing that I seek that I've never had. And I found that AA adopted the same thing, unity, service, recovery, same stuff. Unity's the body, I bring it here. I have to come into the fellowship, I have to be with you. I couldn't get sober, but we seem to be able to. So I have to be with you, the ones that I ultimately will love for the rest of my life. It's so strange to me to have lived the isolated life that I live, and to know that I can come to a place like an astronaut and blast me across the sky, which you know is my favorite thing to do, get an airplane. You know what I mean? It makes perfect sense to me. Just getting a big metal cylinder again and go rocketing across the earth. Yeah, that's a good idea. But the only thing that'll get me to do it is AA. Because I get to prove I'm willing to go to any length every time I get in an airplane. Because my head says, bad idea. It scares me to death. Anyway, where the hell am I? I don't know what I'm talking about. Very hard being me sometimes. But a lot of fun always. Now, so, the unity of the body I bring it here, I must be with my fellows. I can love you. I don't have to like you. I don't even have to know you. If you're here, I love you. Because I know what it takes to get a seat in here. You know what I mean? There's a connection that is just so powerful, it's absolutely unbelievable. So the unity of the body I bring it here, I must. The recovery of the mind, the greater aspect of my disease. Right? I need to be relieved of the obsession to drink and use. The book says that the persistence of this illusion is astonishing, that many of us pursue it to the gates of insanity and death. I'm a gate guy. I've been tagged dead. I go to nut houses. That's what I do. I have to stay here. There's absolutely no explanation for how I'm alive anyway. You know, I can't go out there and push it. It's done. My ticket's punched. I have to find a way to stay here. And the only way a guy like me is going to stay here is if I can find a way to be comfortable sober. If I can't get comfortable sober, if I can't stop that beast from whispering in my ear, the day is going to come when he's going to be whispering at just the wrong time for me, and I'm going to get drunk, and I'm a dead man. So I have to be relieved of the obsession. I have to take the option of drinking off the table. I found out how to do it. Pretty simple. Work the steps. You know? So we got the big book. Work the 12 steps as outlined in the big book in the order that they were presented. It's astonishing, you know what I mean, to me, that this was so hard for me to find. Step one was, what's the problem? Lack of power is my dilemma. I may be okay in every other area, but when it comes to drinking, I'm nuts. Right? If lack of power is my dilemma, what's my solution? Step two, that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity, soundness of mind, relieve me of the obsession to drink. I'm in. That's what I'm looking for. Step three says, if you want that step instead of the solution of step two, you better make a decision to do something about it. I said, okay, what do you want me to do? He said, get off the couch, get on your knees, turn your will and your life over to the care of a God you may or may not understand, but do it right now. I said, all right, did it. Got back on the couch. They said, this is all a waste of time unless you immediately embark upon a plan of action. 4 through 9. 4 and 5 is me, 6 and 7 is God, 8 and 9 is you, ain't nobody else to play with. 4 and 5, swallowed large chunks of truth about myself in a 4-column inventory dealing with resentment, fear, and sex. And I took a good hard look. That was a nasty, ugly experience for me. And if you didn't have a nasty, ugly experience with it, then I guess you didn't have a nasty, ugly experience with it. Well, I sure did, man. That was ugly. There were some hard truths for me to accept there. Patterns and behaviors in my life. Guy came into my house. Before God, I read this information to him. He said, good luck, and left the house. With a lot of reading in the book on 8 and 9. A lot of information on 8 and 9. Because you're actually going to let me out of the house and mingle among you. And they know I'm dangerous. So they want to make very, very sure I understand, but I go out and say, I'm very, very sorry. Here's your money. I go back in the house. No big explanation about what a bitchin' spiritual guy I've become. You know, it's not, you know, and I don't have to worry, and the people on that list, go on that list, they don't want my money. They want their money. Give them back their money. Give them, and to make amends needs to change. So, I'm very sorry I stole your car. I estimate the value of the car at $3,000 at the time of the theft. If that's acceptable to you, I'm going to start with this check and I'm going to pay you monthly until I've paid you $3,000. And I'm not going to go steal your car and sell it to pay you for the car I stole from you. I'm not stealing cars anymore. I got to change here. That's what this is about for me. I got to make the change. Who's responsible for it's me. Making change is tough sometimes, man. Sometimes it just comes down to pulling the trigger. You got to just make the move, man. Just make the move and do it. And that's when you find that the experience of taking that action delivers the magic. Taking that action is what will get you the magic, right? And I started to find that out. And I started picking up steam. And what I found out was, you know what? Doing these steps, I'm catching a buzz. The buzz ain't gone. There's a buzz to be had here. The minute I found out I could be stone cold sober and catching a buzz, look out. I got to catch. There's a buzz here? How come nobody told me that? I'm about the buzz. Give me the buzz. So we went at it, man. 10, 11, and 12, keep me in the game. 10, me, 11, God, 12, you. Same groupings, right? Same bunch, right? Chair, I continue to take personal inventory because I just scratched the surface on that first pass, man. I got to get into this. There's worlds within worlds here. I want to go deep because the buzz is deep. I'm going deep. 11, I seek God. Great. Give me the infinite. There's got to be a buzz there, man. Do it. How do I connect to this God? Through prayer and meditation. What do I pray for? The simpler you keep it, the purer the buzz. So I pray for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. That's it. That's it. And I meditate to quiet the mind so that when the answers come, I can hear them. Because they come in the form of a thought, an intuition, a feeling, an idea. They come to me in whispers, you know? Because the beast ain't whispering in my ear anymore. The beast is not whispering in my ear anymore. Because I've worked the 12 steps and I've had an awakening. It's the result of doing that, step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening, been restored to sanity, soundness of mind, relieved of the obsession of drink or use. Not an option. I look at what's going on in my life. I look at the options I have that are available. I look at that list. Drink and use, it ain't there. It ain't there. Because God took that from me. And now I can practice these principles and carry the message. How can I help? Me, God, and you. Me, God, and you. And I can do all three sides of that every single day if I structure my life to make that possible. And the only way I know to structure my life like that is to do what AA suggests that I do. Because it's designed specifically for me. That means I have the honor of doing things like this. I have the honor of running into Mickey B at a conference and just lighting me up, man, because I see her. Because this woman doesn't play. This is serious business for her. She's about the buzz, you know? And those are the ones I like. The ones that are going, you know what? If I'm going to be here, this ain't about, yeah, I'm staying sober, yeah. Put the plug in the jug. No, man. It's like life. You know what I mean? The AA got me back in the game. And you know what? As excited as I get about being a sober man and the way that it's changed my life beyond my wildest dreams, when I sponsor these young men that come to me, and there's a whole bunch of them that I work with, right? I got to allow them their turn. I got to remember that this has been a process for me, a day at a time, and that they get their turn to be new. And it's like, you know, I'll get Louie, and Louie got 9 months, and I'll say, you know what, Louie? Al's talking. Now, I know Al. Al gets up at the podium, and Al throws down, man. I mean, the spiritual pearls are flying. We're all going to catch a buzz tonight because Al's at the podium, right? So I grab Louie for 9 months, and I go, Louie, come on. We're going to go hear Al, and I'm sitting there, and we sit down, and me and Louie are sitting there, and Al's up there, and Al's ripping tonight. And I'm thinking, isn't this great? That I get to be here with 21 years of sobriety, and I get to listen to Al and hear the magic of Al's experience, his strength, his hope. It's just a powerful conduit, this man. And I get to be the one who brings Louie to hear the remarkable experience that is Al. That ain't what's happening. Louie not having the same meeting I'm having. Louie got 9 months. And I got to remember, Louie gets to have his turn. And I got to remember me at 9 months pulling up at Ohio Street. I pull up at Ohio Street 9 months. It's like, okay, we made it. It's good, it's good, it's good. Does it have, okay, park the car, park the car. Bring the keys, bring the keys, because they put the keys in the chair. But... okay, I'm looking for a chair. Where am I going to put them? Okay, there's the guy with the red coat. Put the keys next to the guy with the red coat. Go on. How you doing? Yeah. I'm fine. Yeah, great. Go on. Okay, I'm going to bell. Sit down. Yeah, fine. I said I was fine. All right, I'm fine. I'm sitting right here. Sitting at the meeting, right? Guys up. He's reading something. I didn't get a lot of that. Rarely saw something. More, yeah. You know, a lot going on around in here. Jesus, I don't know. 12 things. There's 12 things in A. 12 things in A. Heard that. Rarely saw something. 12 things in A. ABC. 12 things ABC. 12 things ABC. He's down. I didn't get a lot of that. But that was pretty good. He's down. Another guy's up. He drank. I did that. That was good. He's gone. He's gone. I didn't get a lot of that either. Very short, but I want to talk to that guy. Remember where that guy is. I want to talk to that guy. Keep an eye on that guy. Okay, they're passing a basket. What the hell are they passing a basket for? Don't take the money. Okay, we're getting up. We're going outside. Where are we going? I'm going to go outside. Smoke? I smoke. We'll smoke. Okay, we're smoking. Hey, I'm fine. The ring a bell. We're going in. Where's the guy with the red coat? Red coat. Get there. Sit down. Oh, Christ. Staying in class forever. Goodness, they're reading 12 things. I was not saying 12 things. Okay, 24 things, ABC. 24 things, ABC. 24 things. Another guy, he's up. He drank. I did that. This guy's great. I felt like that. This guy is great. I felt like this. This guy's been reading my mail. This is absolutely amazing. I love that guy. I have to talk to him. I have to talk to that man. He's down. That was excellent. Excellent. 24 things, ABC. Talk to that guy. I got to talk to that guy. And then, they got me. We're praying. All right, we're praying. I know this prayer. Say the prayer. And then I would go and I would cry all the way home. I'm walking out of the meeting. I would walk up to some guy and say, you know, what'd you think of the meeting? And I'd say, it's great. And that meeting was a total victory for a guy like me because I was insane. So when I'm sitting listening to Alan, I got little Lou here sitting next to me 9 months, and we walk out of the meeting, and I look at Lou, and I say, Lou, what'd you think of the meeting? He looks up, and he says, it's great. I think, okay, we're on track, man. You know, he made it through the meeting. He did not stand up in the meeting and say, I'm sorry, I have to go kill myself now. You know, he sat there. He didn't pull a gun on anybody. His head did not literally explode off of his body. He made it through a meeting. We're getting somewhere. We're in it together. And that's the thing that I always got to remember, that we're in this together. Wherever you are on your path is what you're doing. Wherever I'm on my path is what I'm doing. And what we do is we come here and we don't tell each other what to do. We share our experience, our strength, and our hope with each other. And we do it in different ways. And one guy gets a buzz from that guy, and this woman gets a buzz from that woman. And we all rise up out of a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Because, I mean, look, I don't know many people up here, but I'm in Seaside, Oregon, and I got a room full of dead people sitting up looking at me pretending they're paying attention. You know what I mean? So I know this thing works, and if you're new, don't miss it, man. There is a buzz to be had here. There is a way to look out of your skull and experience your life, and it's here. It's right in there, man. Just get between those. Just remember I told you before, for me, it was about, I had to get out of right here, right now. I go up, I go down, I don't care, but I got to get out of right now, because right here, right now is too frightening. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me back right here, right now. This moment, right now, and there isn't anything else. This is life. This is life. This is where I'm going to know. Any love I'm going to know is a man I'm going to know right here. Any ability I have to give anything of value to another human being is going to have to happen right now. It's going to happen right now because it can't happen back then and it can't happen up ahead. It's got to happen now. I got to have right now. I got to be here. This is where my life is. This is where any honor or dignity I'll know is. This is where the buzz is right now. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the tools to not be afraid to go ahead and be here right now. That's a gift beyond anything I ever could have imagined. So this isn't for me about just not drinking. This is about a design for living, where a completely useless, broken, insane human being like me, who had nothing anybody wanted, could come to live a life of value and purpose. And it's who I got introduced to in here is Earl. Who you're going to get introduced to in here is you. And I invite you to do that with us. With us. I mean, these people look like normal, regular citizens. I assure you, they're not. You know? They're us. Look in their eyes. The eyes give it away. You can see it in their eyes. And you know what? If you're new, they will love you like no one else on earth can. They will love you like no one on earth can. Because they're just you down the road a little ways. That's all. And they know it. So come be with us, because we love you. And I love all of you. Thanks a lot.